right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton, and our next guest is Chalmers Johnson. He's the president of the Japan Policy Research Institute, is a former consultant to the Central Intelligence Agency, taught for 30 years at the University of California at Berkeley and at San Diego. He's written 16 books, including Okinawa, Cold War Island, Blowback, The Costs and Consequences of American Empire, and The Sorrows of Empire, Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Well, it's nice to have you on. You have called yourself a former spear carrier for empire, Mr. Johnson. What exactly does that mean, and how did that change?
Well, I'm simply referring to the fact that during the Cold War, I did believe that the Soviet Union was a menace. I worked at that time in support of American foreign policy. It seemed that in general, with some very serious exceptions, but in general, it was on the right path. I changed my mind during the 1990s. John Maynard Keynes, the famous English economist, was once accused of being inconsistent, and his reply to say, "When I get new information, I change my position. What, sir, do you do with new information?" The new information I got was the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, in which, rather than beginning to scale back our massive deployments around the world to bring the military-industrial complex under control, things of this sort, instead our government set out instantaneously to find a replacement enemy for the Soviet Union, to keep the whole apparatus of Pentagon, Central Intelligence Agency, military-industrial complex, arms manufacturing, and general imperialism, to keep it operating and functioning. They would go for anything: China, drugs, terrorism, instability, whatever it might be. This raised in my mind the question that once the primary explanation, the primary justification for the Cold War and for the massive expenditures the Americans had made during 40 years of it, when this simply disappeared, and that there was no peace dividend, it raised then in my mind the question, was the Cold War in fact a cover for something more basic, for a fundamental American imperialist project that had been brewing and coming into being since at least the Second World War, when we emerged as the dominant power on Earth, and that a project to replace the British Empire with our own leadership? I believe that's the case. The second thing that caused me really to change my mind was I've worked primarily on East Asia, on China and Japan. In 1996, I was invited to the southernmost Japanese island, Okinawa Prefecture, by the governor in the wake of an extremely serious incident that had occurred on September 4th, 1995, when two Marines and a sailor from one of our 38 military bases on this very small island had abducted, beaten, and raped a 12-year-old girl. It set off the largest demonstrations against the United States since the security treaty had been signed back in 1960. It revealed the ongoing grievances of the people who are forced to live cheek by jowl with American troops and their generally ill-disciplined and ill-led behavior. I accepted the governor's invitation, came and talked to him and others. I was shocked by what I saw, the impact of these bases on an island smaller than Kauai and the Hawaiian Islands with 1.3 million people, the indifference of our government to what they imposed on others. My first reaction was that Okinawa had to be exceptional. It was off the beaten track. Journalists very rarely went down there. The Marine Corps is absolute geniuses at public relations and control of Congress.
But it turned out this is the same kind of story all over the world.
That's what happened. I began to investigate it. That led to the book called The Sorrows of Empire.
Okay, we'll be right back. It's the Weekend Interview Show. We're talking with Chalmers Johnson. My friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Chalmers Johnson, the author of the excellent book, Sorrows of Empire, Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic. His website is jpri.org. And interestingly, Mr. Johnson, I read an article not too long ago. It was a foreign affairs article from 1995 called From, I believe it was From Trotskyism to Anachronism by John B. Judas. And in that article, he lists you as a former neoconservative who became a realist. And I thought it was funny he mentioned your name right there with Gene Kirkpatrick. But in any case, I wondered if you think that's an accurate description?
Well, I don't know that you say neoconservative. I don't think there's anything particularly neo about it. Gene Kirkpatrick and I were both members of the editorial board of the National Interest. I don't know that I'm particularly a realist today. I don't like these labels. I don't think they're helpful. They're full of academic gossip and competition. But there is no doubt that I believe the events since the end of the Cold War compel, and particularly today, given the really very perilous circumstances the United States finds itself in the rest of the world, that what it's called for here is a new, innovative, powerful, no-holds-barred debate on American foreign policy, on the nature of our government, on where we're going. If we, it may be too late already to make much difference. Empires all collapse, and in recent times they collapse fairly rapidly. But that's what I've been motivated to do, is, as getting to be an old man, is to write books and compile information on this subject.
And once you saw that perhaps the Cold War wasn't really so much about containing communism as using that as an excuse to really set the basis for American empire, once you realize that, when you look back at American history, at what point do you place the origins of American empire? Because from a certain point of view, you could go all the way back to the Louisiana Purchase, right?
Well, precisely. I mean, you could go back to the creation of the Republic itself, where, I mean, after all, Theodore Roosevelt once said, imperialism, or imperialists, there aren't any imperialists in America, but expansionism, it's in our blood. So that it just depends on the context in which you'd care to put it. But I think in terms of genuine imperialism, we tend to date it from the Spanish-American War, from our acquisition of things as odd, given the beliefs of our founders and the way in which our country had developed, the acquisition of colonies in the Philippines, in the Caribbean. Cuba would be an American colony if it were not for the competition of Florida, and things of that sort. It then accelerated greatly under the influence of Woodrow Wilson and our entry into the First World War, basically driven, in the case of Wilson, by religious fanaticism. The United States reacted quite violently to him after the First World War. The true foundations of our imperialism then come in the Second World War, when we developed this huge military apparatus, spread bases around the world. We did, as had been our tradition in the past, reacted against that as soon as the war ended, but then the Cold War came along to replace that. To a certain extent, I think we have to look back and say the real crisis of the United States in the 20th century was the so-called Great Depression, and particularly the fact that despite the apotheosis of Franklin Roosevelt, we overcame it only in the context of war, World War II, and then we continued it in the Cold War. We are easily the world's largest arms manufacturers by orders of magnitude, and to a certain extent, we have been at war since 1940. But it's so that I think that the true roots are to be found in the Second World War, but there are intellectual roots, early examples, or early theorizing that go back a very long ways, and where many of the euphemisms to cover what we were doing were invented, including manifest destiny and things like that.
Now, I thought it was very interesting in your book. You say that there were actually three Cold Wars going on up through 1989, 1991, during that time, and that when the wall came down, really what happened was only one of the three Cold Wars ended. The other two kept going. Which other two Cold Wars are you referring to?
Well, the two that I mean, particularly are the one in East Asia, the ones in East Asia, where we have we've turned Japan into a solid satellite of the United States. Our continued opposition to China, even though it would be greatly to our security advantage and our economic advantage if we would cooperate with China as it emerges as a commercial powerhouse. The other, of course, is the one that's been going on in Latin America since, in many ways, the war with Spain in 1898. In that context, you must say communism and Fidel Castro have been enormously advantageous to us since our traditional relations with Latin America were purely imperialist, going back to the Monroe Doctrine, where we have kept these people under our thumb and exploited them economically. Once you had a pro-Soviet regime in Cuba, then we could use as a cover for everything we did there, from the overthrow of the Guatemalan government down to our massive use of the world's greatest military force against small Central American republics during the Reagan administration. The cover there was that we were trying to prevent the spread of communism into the Western Hemisphere. But the wars in the Third World, and particularly in Latin America, and the ones in East Asia, were not affected in any way by the collapse of the Cold War in Europe.
They just needed to find new excuses now.
They certainly did.
And they used, particularly in Latin America, they used the drug war.
Yes.
As their excuse. And, of
Absolutely.
Course, Clinton liked humanitarian aid was mm-hmm. always his excuse, right?
Well, I argue in The Sorrows of Empire that if you really are an American imperialist, you'd have to say that Clinton was a more clever imperialist than George Bush, because Clinton did effectively, he had a real strategy. He disguised what we were doing under the cover of humanitarian intervention, things of this sort, globalization, euphemisms that tended to protect us from direct responsibility, and that's what we mean by strategy, the indirect approach, disguising your true intent, whereas George Bush just drops the mask and says, we are the new Rome, beats his chest like a gorilla, and gives fair warning to, or genuine warning to everyone on earth, prepare to resist the American juggernaut. We see that today there's not a nation on earth that isn't beginning to do that.
And you point out in your book there are now 725 American bases that we know of
yes.
in at least 153 countries around
That's right.
the world.
That's from the base structure report, the annual inventory of real estate owned by the Pentagon that is not classified, put out every year. It is, I think, really one of the shocking facts of the American empire today, that it's not an empire of colonies, it's an empire of military bases. They stretch from Greenland to Australia, from Japan to Latin America. We deploy well over 500,000 soldiers, spies, teachers, contractors on these bases. Some of them are part of the military petroleum complex. They provide a great deal of work for Americans who service the military in one way or another. And again, as I say, the 725 is simply the number that the Pentagon has decided to acknowledge. There's one of the things I go into in The Sorrows of Empire are the numbers of bases not included, none of the espionage bases. The bases in England are all disguised as if they were Royal Air Force bases. The bases that are being built in Iraq, the bases in Israel, in much of Central Asia, these are simply not reported. The big base in the Balkans, Camp Bondsteel, is definitely it's one of the largest bases we've ever built. It was built by Kellogg-Brenneroot in 1999. The Army likes to say there's only two human manufactured devices you can see from outer space. One is the Great Wall of China, and the other is Camp Bondsteel. It's located directly on the route of an oil pipeline that we are planning to build across the Balkans from the Black Sea.
Oh, what a coincidence.
To the Adriatic. Yes. And that's why I'm almost sure that's why it is simply not reported in the base structure report.
And all the newest bases seems like where the, I guess the military types call it, our footprint,
yes.
is moving further east and deeper into Central Asia near the Caspian Sea. And I'm sure you know about the recent coup d'etat in Kyrgyzstan,
yes.
where there's American air bases there.
Well, they're moving into oil-rich areas above all, yes.
What do you think about these color-coded revolutions? It seems like there's always a lot of outside money. Is this all CIA operations over
here? It certainly has that look to it. It's a pattern that's been developed for a long time. And the CIA doesn't, once they get a technique that works, they don't change it very often. They carry out these coups against any number of other countries. But it usually involves a large number of NGOs and non-governmental organizations. What in the days of the Communist International would have been called front organizations. We sponsor a great many of them around the world and claim that they're there to promote democracy. They're actually there to promote American imperialism. The president takes this up with his business about the march of democracy on earth. We've now done it in the former Soviet Union, in Georgia, in the Ukraine, and now it looks very much like the case in Kyrgyzstan, where we have a major military base. This may backfire on us, but certainly from some reports by the American ambassador in Bishkek, the Kyrgyz capital, the man who has come to power, Mr. Bakiyev, was our preferred candidate, and we'll see how successful he turns out to be. But yes, the whole thing begins to have an odor to it.
It's starting to. It's a weekend interview show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Chalmers Johnson, author of Sorrows of Empire. We'll be right back. All right, my friends, welcome back to the weekend interview show. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Chalmers Johnson. He is the president of the Japan Policy Research Institute and author of The Sorrows of Empire, Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic. Now, sir, a topic that you spend quite a bit of time on in your book is the idea that the empire of bases that we create and that we always find new excuses for keeping, that they create what you call blowback, and that is always then used, of course, as an excuse to expand the empire even further.
Yes.
We see this. In fact, in your book, you go on about the bases all across the Saudi Peninsula, not just in Saudi Arabia, but in Oman and Bahrain and Qatar and throughout the Middle East. And also you point out that Iran is the last country left in the Middle East that we don't have bases in or at least threaten.
We certainly have them surrounded.
Yes, we do have them surrounded. Do you think that Iran is next?
It's hard to say. I mean, again, the exact motives of our government remain deeply unclear and changing to meet new circumstances. That is, there's, I believe, at heart, one of the fundamental motives is petroleum, is the desire to maintain our extremely profligate use of fossil fuels, refuse to conserve, and to refuse to acknowledge that, in fact, the world's supply of petroleum is starting to run out. I think we're also motivated by a odd conglomeration of groups in America who are totally committed to the support of Israel, regardless of what it does and how it does it. They will they're prepared to do anything in their power to defend Israel, even though it is itself easily the most powerful country in the Middle East. Beyond that, I think there is the reality of imperialism itself, that the United States has gotten used to it. We have huge vested interests in the imperial system. That is, manufacturing in America on any big project, like, say, the B-2 bomber, a piece of it is put in every single state so that if any member of Congress ever got the idea that maybe we didn't need one more new weapon of massive destruction, that you can destroy him politically by pulling out the factory, things of this sort. So the requisites of the empire itself. And then there are the political demands of a president and a vice president, secretary of defense, who, in my opinion, have misread the world, but nonetheless believe that we can dominate it through military power alone, and that this will go on for some length of time, that they have talked about the need for between 50 to 60 regime change wars to make the world look the way we want to. All of these things add up to contributing to this massive commitment around the world, but it is, I believe, one built on very weak foundations.
This doesn't seem to have much to do with the war on terrorism, except for perhaps creating circumstances where more people will want to be terrorists.
Well, I think really the opposite. There's no question that we are creating terrorism. Blowback is a term that was invented by the CIA after its first overthrow of an elected foreign government that we disapproved of. That was the government of Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran in 1953, when, at the interest of the British Petroleum Company, we declared that he was a communist. The Pope would have been a better candidate than Mossadegh, and then overthrew his government. In the after-action report that was declassified just in the year 2000, the agency speaks of how these actions are going to produce some blowback. Blowback means retaliation, but it means more than retaliation. It means retaliation for things our government has done abroad clandestinely, and that have been kept secret, above all, from the American public. They're, of course, never kept secret from the people on the receiving end. But when the retaliation comes, it then means the public doesn't have the information to put it in context, to see cause and effect, so that presidents can get away with asking questions like, as Bush did after 9/11, why did they hate us? When, as if you'd had, if you'd looked into it, you'd have wondered, why don't more people hate us? I remember on 9/11 itself, I was talking with my publisher, in which she had called me up to say, blowback big time just hit. But we didn't yet know who the terrorists were. We speculated on it. My first thought was 9/11, the September 11th. It's a date extremely well known in Latin America. That's the date we overthrew the elected government of Chile and imposed one of the most odious regimes that have been experienced anywhere on earth, namely that of General Pinochet. And then I thought at first, maybe they were Chileans, but they could have been Okinawans, they could have been East Timorese, they could have been any number of Africans, they could have been Greeks, who will never forgive us, the Greek colonels between 1967 and 73. It could have been any number of people. It turned out to be Islamicists, reflecting the largest clandestine operation the CIA ever carried out. That was the arming, recruiting, sending into battle of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan against the Soviet Union during the 1980s. After we had exhausted our interest in them, we dumped them. They didn't like that, and they began to retaliate against us. But it's, yes, blowback is the reality of the world we live in. That was the meaning of the book that I published before 9/11, I want to stress. To say we're going to pay the cost for much of our foreign policy during the Cold War.
All right. Well, I'll go ahead and say this. We'll get back from the break. All right. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Chalmers Johnson, author of Sorrows of Empire. We'll be right back.
Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town.
All right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and my guest is Chalmers Johnson. He's the author of the book, The Sorrows of Empire, Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic. And, sir, on the topic of blowback, you said, you know, part of the qualification for blowback is it's not just unintended consequences of intervention overseas, but it's consequences of interventions that the American people don't know about, so that when it does blow back, we don't even know exactly what it is we're dealing with. And it ties into what you said before about our empire is not really a traditional empire of colonies. It's a empire of bases and of briefcases, where we don't really have redcoat soldiers occupying all these lands, just occupying little bases within these lands because we've reached an agreement. And we have IMF and World Bank loans and different kinds of...
It depends tremendously on secrecy, too. I mean, that the... that's why in the subtitle of The Sorrows of Empire, I call it Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic, that it's just simply out of control. 40% of the defense budget is secret. All of the intelligence budgets are secret. The government adds 3 million or so new military secrets every year. It was 14 million last year that they added. This is utterly destructive of our Republican, little r, form of government, of the liberties that we depend upon, but that it is precisely that that is contributing to this growth of militarism and of empire that perhaps the two most famous generals in our political life, George Washington and Dwight Eisenhower, both warned against in their farewell addresses, the dangers of very large standing armies developing their own vested interests. When one says militarism, we're not talking about defense of the country. I'm a Navy veteran from the Korean War. I have no objection at all to defending the country. By militarism, we're talking about the military developing vested interests in its own corporate way of life, its state socialism, its cradle-to-grave medical care, its 725 military bases around the world, that sort of thing.
So it's you call militarism when the military is so far out of control that it really exists only for its own sake.
Exactly.
And you addressed before the ideology of American empire, and in your book you talk about the Theodore Roosevelt versus the Woodrow Wilson view of American takeover of the world, where Theodore Roosevelt just said, hey, let's be like Britain and let's civilize those savages.
Yeah.
Whereas Woodrow Wilson was sort of this kind of one-world utopian who thought that he was going to make everything wonderful, and how since that era, the progressive era, our presidents have basically traded off which excuse they're using for taking over the world, but they're always still advancing the very same empire.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, the neoconservatives that dominate the Pentagon today, all of them claim authority for their positions in the views of Woodrow Wilson, and we see it now in the president's wheeling out something that he calls the March of Democracy on Earth. It actually is the March of Imperialism, and he may trap himself with it very badly if he really does get if he's really been promoting democracy in Kyrgyzstan or in places like that. If you get a genuinely democratic government in Kyrgyzstan, it's not going to be friendly to the United States. It's going to be full of Islamic fundamentalists, particularly from the southern part of the country, and that these things will get out of control very, very rapidly. We know they aren't really talking about democracy. This is a way of providing a cover for an essentially poorly informed and remarkably gullible American public.
At the bottom line of this is the mercantilist kind of the welfare state for rich people.
Yes.
Basically. That's really what this is all about. You talked about they can't build a bomber without making sure that at least one part is manufactured in each state of the union.
Right. Well, I mean, take, for example, the state of Washington has two extremely pleasant female senators, liberals, utterly decent people. All you have to do is say the word Boeing to them, and they turn at once into bloodlusting fascist hyenas. They will do anything in their power to protect Boeing. That the two mother hens of the Defense Facilities Subcommittee of the Senate Armed Services Committee are Kay Bailey Hutchinson of Texas and Dianne Feinstein of California. These two women will fight to the last to keep these bases open and functioning wherever they are, because there are Americans who today make their living off of building weapons and with very little interest in how they're actually used. It's a that's why one really does wonder if any president, regardless of party, could possibly bring under control the new government, the government that's not included in the Constitution, that's located on the south bank of the Potomac River, namely in the Pentagon and the Central Intelligence Agency, that more or less does as it pleases, and now has a good 50 years record in doing just that, and for which the Congress is more or less worthless.
Has there ever been a civilization that could have been an empire and yet rejected the temptation because of the consequences foreseen? Has that ever happened?
I think only in the sense of an empire of ideas, an empire of culture, in that sense, much like ancient Greece, or for that matter, the Chinese Empire, which was much more an empire of the ideals of good government expressed in Confucianism, things of this sort, in which the surrounding nations chose to try and emulate China, and in which the Chinese very distinctly did not have an ethnic or nationalistic identity. It was a cultural identity. So that it's not as though that it's unknown. And something like that, I think, was there in the original United States, which, after all, influenced Latin America to throw off Spanish rule, the idea of republican government, of small government, of the division, the separation of powers, and the holding down of what today plagues us, namely an imperial presidency. So that I don't think it's inconceivable, but in terms of the military-based empire of the, that is, military dictatorship, for all intents and purposes, of the, which the first example, important example, was the Roman Empire as successor to the Roman Republic, these contain the seeds of their own destruction. They do all, I mean, the Roman Empire may have taken 3 centuries to go down. In my lifetime, you start to see them falling very rapidly. In the case of the Soviet Union, it really only took 3 years between 1989 and 1991. But just in my lifetime, you've seen the end of the Nazi, Imperial Japanese, British, French, Dutch, Portuguese, and Soviet empires. There's simply no reason to believe that the Americans aren't treading that same path as they set off to dominate the world and to have misread the end of the Cold War. They misread it to believe that we had won it, as we like to say. The truth of the matter is, both the U.S. and the USSR lost it. It's just they lost it much worse than we did because they were always a much poorer country.
Well, and they had an economic system based on central planning, which...
No doubt about that.
...just can't work.
Right.
What do you think about the NATO-EU split? During the 1990s, it seems like our guys were trying really hard to bring in all the former Soviet republics in Eastern Europe as fast as they could so as to surround what Rumsfeld calls old Europe with new European nations involved in NATO. And on the other side of that argument, particularly the Germans and the French, were pushing the idea of perhaps creating their own EU army that would operate separately and distinctly from NATO.
Yes.
How do you think that that's working out since Bush has taken such a middle finger in the face of everybody kind of attitude?
Well, there's no question that the French have reacted to America's claim of being the lone superpower, of having its own way, of being the new Rome, of basically a colossus athwart the world, and have claimed that the world would be a safer, more comfortable place with multipolarity, with different centers of power. I happen to agree with him. Right now, easily the most important growing new power is China. Been growing at 9.5% per year for the last 20 years. Its leading trading partner is the European Union. So we are beginning to see the outlines of a Chinese EU entente confronting an American Japanese entente, both of which seem to be in a good deal of economic decline. In the case of NATO, it's simply an anachronism. It was created as a formal military alliance back in 1949, directed against the Soviet Union. With the collapse of the Soviet Union, it no longer had any function. It seems to me that one has simply been asking for trouble to continue to expand the countries surrounding the former Soviet Union to add these to NATO. If we have been playing games in, as I believe we have, in Georgia, Ukraine, and now Kyrgyzstan, well, believe me, these are, the Russians are masters at playing this game, and it can be played against us quite vigorously in the future. But it seems to me the EU is having stops and starts. I believe it has expanded too rapidly, though in a certain sense it is a sign of its success. That is, the president keeps talking about the march of democracy. The truth of the matter is, the real march of democracy, if there is such a thing on earth today, it is the European Union and the desperate desire of countries from the Baltic to Turkey to become part of comfortable Western European life. And it may have gone a little fast, but I think now there may be setbacks, but it is essentially irreversible. Once it is more fully consolidated, it will be considerably larger economically than the United States. Whether it wishes to develop the same kind of military strength the United States does, we'll wait to see. I certainly hope they do not. I don't think it's necessary to have the influence that they want to have.
It's interesting all the different power blocks. You talk about the alliances where we could end up with the French and the Germans in a power block allied with the Russians,
yeah,
as opposed to being allied with us and the British.
Well, it's an interesting thing that as a teacher of American international relations and foreign policy, we have always argued that one of the fundamental issues of American foreign policy was try to prevent an alliance between Paris, Berlin, and Moscow. Well, we have that now, largely as a result of our own bungling and misreading of the way the world is going, and probably the most remarkably incompetent set of political leaders. I mean, we have a Secretary of State now who goes around the world demanding people help us, as she did in China just this past week, and then insulting the very same people that she's asking for assistance from. This is not diplomacy. This is grandstanding for the purpose of a short-term domestic political advantage.
Well, and as a result, we get the Russians and the Chinese doing joint military training together.
Well, exactly.
Massive war games. So
it's like the Roman Empire. The rest of the world now knows we're there, knows what we stand for, has seen that we're willing to act on it, as in the case of the war with Iraq, regardless of the intelligence that we allegedly had on it being totally erroneous. Under these circumstances, you have to start preparing for it. It is the greatest single force for nuclear proliferation you could imagine right now, that any nation looking at the United States has got to say, the only thing that will stop them, if they want to put you on a list of axis of evil or whatever it may be, the only thing that will stop them is nuclear weapons. That we now know what was wrong with Saddam Hussein was that he didn't have weapons of mass destruction.
Isn't that an interesting point, too?
If he had, we'd really treated him a lot more seriously.
Well, and the North Koreans and the Iranians have taken two different tactics.
Right.
The North Koreans have kicked out the IAEA and turned off the cameras and are apparently making bombs as fast as they can. The Iranians are opening their books wide open, and it's not protecting them at all.
Well, I mean, and by the same token, though, I guarantee you that, say, a country like Brazil today, Lula da Silva's Brazil, we have some really nasty arguments with them over economics. They are starting to trade very heavily with China right now. I'm reasonably certain that President da Silva goes into a secure room with his cabinet at some point and says, look, we used to have a nuclear weapons program. We stopped it because of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. We have uranium in this country. We could, if they put us on a list and start coming after us, throwing their weight around, what I want to know is how fast can we get the same thing the North Koreans have, the same thing that the Iranians are close to having, and that's going on in every country on Earth right now. It's that being the case, I don't think it's a time to envy the young.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, just to think about it, that sounds so surreal, I think. I mean, for someone who follows policy very closely all the time, maybe, but for the average American to hear, wait, the Brazilians are worried now?
Well, they're worried about the way in which we like to push, the kind of war we fought in Iraq, the way we kid ourselves that because we had an election on January 30th, the place has become a democracy. You can't very well have. I mean, that is just across the border in Syria, we're saying you can't have a genuine election there unless you get rid of Syrian military occupation. As we say that, we don't seem to realize that, of course, we have an absolute stranglehold of military occupation on Iraq. Why on earth should one pay any attention to this rigged election that has been held, or that it should mean anything once the Iraqis actually have control of their own lives again? If they ever do, given the fact that they sit on so much oil and that we essentially want to steal their resources. Of course, these are the things that are creating enormous instability in the world, and that to say that the American people don't realize it is a reflection of the failure of the economic monopolies that control the media in this country, the kind of information they're not getting about the only attractive aspect of this is the Internet and the ability to read newspapers in England or in or to look at antiwar.com. It's not a left-wing website at all. It's basically libertarian. But it is one of the best digests of information you won't read in your own newspapers. But it's not enough. And I kept wondering, why did John Ashcroft take so long to begin to bring the Internet under control? Because it weakens the attempt of the imperial presidency to keep the public docile and following in the footsteps that they would like them to go. But yes, these are very dangerous times. I'm working on a third book now, called The Crisis of the American Republic, which is concerned precisely with the trap we're walking into.
And it really is a trap. That sure is what it's shaping up to be. And in fact, I think when we get back from this break, we'll spend this last segment on the actual sorrows of empire and what sort of consequences we have coming around the bend for us here at home. Empire weakens us, turns out. It doesn't make us stronger. It destroys
us. True.
All right, it's a weekend interview show, and we'll be right back with Chalmers Johnson. All right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. The guest is Chalmers Johnson. He is the president of the Japan Policy Research Institute. The website is jpri.org. And he's the author of the books Blow Back, The Costs and Consequences of American Empire and The Sorrows of Empire, Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic. Now, sir, on the sorrows of empire, we've already pretty much discussed the blowback and each intervention creates more intervention. And the three left on your list, and I have a couple of my own, are the role of the president as he really becomes the American Caesar, and the destruction of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, the propaganda machine teaching us more and more to worship the warfare state, and eventually the collapse. So if we could possibly plow through those three subjects quickly in the last segment here, beginning with the imperial presidency.
The imperial presidency is what's been warned against from George Washington's farewell address, in which he said the large standing armies are an enemy of liberty and particularly of Republican liberty, referring to our separation of powers between the presidency as an executive branch, the Congress as a legislative branch, and then a judicial review branch. There's no question. I mean, the author of our Constitution, or the most important author, James Madison, said explicitly the single most important clause in the Constitution is the one giving the right to go to war exclusively to the elected representatives of the people. Never, he wrote, under any circumstances should that power be given to a single man. It's too great a responsibility. In October of 2002, our Congress gave that power to a single man when he chose to use it, using nuclear weapons if he wanted to. And 9 months later, he went to war in Iraq, and it turns out to be a wrong-headed war in which he had lied to the Congress and the people about why we're doing it. Now, that's the kind of trouble we're in. My own feeling is that the irrevocable step, the crossing the Rubicon, occurred last November 2nd. Until then, it was possible for the American public to pretend that we had not elected George Bush. He didn't win a majority of the population in the 2000 election. He was appointed by the Supreme Court. On November 2nd, he won by 3.5 million votes. That essentially meant that now official torture of people that we capture, preventive war, which is a polite word for what the Japanese did to us on December 7th, 1941, of out-of-control budgets, and of continuing, that is, something in the neighborhood of $700 billion per annum once you add it all up, going to the military in one form or another, including taking care of our wounded, all of that is now not George Bush anymore. It's the American public. It's nationalized, and that's the way we're seen in the rest of the world. That's very, very hard to reverse. And that you begin to think that imperial overstretch is catching up with us very rapidly.
In this last minute here, I guess, can I get you to prefer that we collapse in the way the Soviet Union did as opposed to the way Nazi Germany did?
Oh, yes, certainly I would prefer that. I think my wife keeps saying to me, tell me something positive, something optimistic. And I have to say, well, probably the thing that will get us, even if the American public is totally indifferent to what happens to its constitution, to permanent war, one thing after another, bankruptcy is something beyond our control.
And let's hope it's bankruptcy that gets us and not foreign armies.
I'm sorry to say bankruptcy would turn us into a North American version of Argentina, but that wouldn't be the end of the world.
And better than some of the other alternatives. Thank
Absolutely.
You so much for this time. Chalmers Johnson, author of Sorrows of Empire. Thank you, sir.
Mr. Horton, thank you very much.
All right, everybody. We'll be back next week. The website is weekendinterviewshow.com.